Welcome to Talking History and this special Halloween show. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The witchcraft trial of Urban Grandier is an extraordinary tale of conspiracy, corruption, and mass hysteria. It's a good case where truth is stranger than fiction, and not surprisingly, it has been the source of a novel by Aldous Huxley and a film by Ken Russell. It's also the subject of today's show. But before we get to that, let's take a look at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1881, lawman and outlaw Wyatt Earp, his brothers, and their longtime friend Doc Holliday took part in what has become known in Western folklore as the shootout at the OK Corral. Earp and most of his family moved to Tombstone, Arizona in 1878 after a stint as assistant marshal in Dodge City, Kansas. His brother Virgil became Tombstone's town marshal. Wyatt took up gambling. By 1881, a feud developed between the Earps and a gang led by Ike Clanton, and on October 26th, the feud was resolved in the celebrated gunfight, pitting the Clanton gang against three Earp brothers, Virgil, Wyatt, and Morgan, and Doc Holliday. Three of the Clanton gang were killed, but Ike and another gang member escaped. The townspeople discharged Virgil Earp on suspicion that the shootings were murder rather than crime fighting, but the Earps were never convicted of any crimes related to that famous event. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, according to a new book based on KGB files brought to the West by a Soviet defector, the KGB fabricated evidence linking the CIA to the assassination of President John Kennedy and passed the material to conspiracy theorists in the United States. One such item, a letter purportedly written by Lee Harvey Oswald to CIA officer E. Howard Hunt, was passed to the West soon after the 1963 assassination. The ploy is reported in The Sword and the Shield, written by Christopher Andrew and former KGB officer Vasily Mitrokhin. Newly discovered personal letters written by civil rights leader Malcolm X might shed some light on what drove an ordinary child to become an extraordinary leader. The letters, donated for display at Emory University by Malcolm's half-sister Ella Collins, also dispel some long-held misconceptions that he was a belligerent, troublemaking youth. Written when he was between 13 and 15 years of age, they portray the future black separatist as articulate, systematic, and organized in his everyday experiences. In one letter written while he was in the eighth grade, Malcolm lists his various classmates along with their positive and negative qualities. You're listening to Talking History. Between 1450 and 1700, approximately 50 to 60,000 people, perhaps many more, were executed for practicing witchcraft, a practice deemed heretical by Roman Catholic and Protestant churches alike and a capital crime by most countries in Europe and their colonies in America. The Salem Witch Trials of 1692 may be best known to our listeners, but certainly one of the more dramatic and interesting cases of all is that of Father Urban Grandier, a Catholic priest, a case that took place in Loudun, France, 60 years earlier. The Grandier case has been the subject of a Ken Russell movie and Aldous Huxley novel, and now an excellent new history, A Case of Witchcraft, The Trial of Urban Grandier, written by our guest today, Robert Rapley, and published by McGill Queen's University Press of Canada. Robert Rapley joins us today from his home in Ottawa, Canada. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you give us just a brief summary of the Grandier case?
Sure. The date is August 1617, and Urbain Grandier, a young priest, arrives in Loudun. He's brilliant, he's handsome, he's charismatic, he's a great preacher, and he spent 12 years there, confidant of the most powerful men in the city. And suddenly, in 1629, he was accused of seducing women for those 12 years, and it was said that no woman was safe from his advances. Now, he managed to prove that those accusations were false. It took him 2 years, and he seemed to be in the clear until suddenly, right after that, the nuns in a local convent showed signs of demonic possession. They accused Grandier of being responsible, and the peculiar thing was that they'd never even seen him. possessions grew worse bit by bit. The priests and the doctors declared that the nuns really were truly possessed. And Grandier fought against these accusations for 2 years. But finally, he was tried, he was found guilty, and he was burned at the stake as a sorcerer or a witch in 1634. And the questions have always been since then, were the nuns possessed? Was Grandier responsible? And who wanted Grandier dead, and why?
Now, this case doesn't take place in isolation. I mean, there are other witch trials going on before and after. Is it rather typical of the cases of that particular time, or is it atypical for whatever reason?
I think it's typical of the cases of the time in terms of the types of evidence that were produced at the trial. There were certain things that witches were believed to do or believed to have, like marks on the body that were insensitive, pacts with the devil, attendance at a Sabbath. And these events appeared in practically every witchcraft trial. So to that extent, it was typical. What was not typical was the size and importance of this trial, because it really was a national issue, and yet it took place in a small provincial town. So, yes, in some respects it was typical, and in some respects it was not.
Tell us a little bit about this town, because in your book you described Loudun as a troubled town.
Right.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, it was a town of about 14,000 people, which was quite a sizable town in those days. A very strong fortress, beautiful walls, white walls. It looked like a fairy city from a distance. But though it was a beautiful city, it was a very divided city. Part of the reason was that half of the population was Catholic and half was Huguenot or Calvinist. Now, that doesn't mean very much to us today, but at that time, these two religions were bitter enemies. They were mortal enemies. And within the town, each side feared that the others would rise up and start a bloodbath at any time. And there was cause for this. There had been religious wars in France ever since the Reformation. Peacetime, they coexisted together. But if there was great stress, then they were liable to open enmity with each other. That was one aspect. This became particularly important when Grandier was accused, because the Catholic exorcists used those exorcisms to attack Calvinism. They wanted to prove that the Catholic Church had power to expel demons. Then there were two other factors in here. There were personal rivalries between some of the leading families, and nobody could sort of sit in the middle. You had to be friends of one, you had to be, and if you were friends of one, then you became the enemy of the other. And that again became very significant once Grandier was accused of witchcraft. And finally, the king planned to destroy all the fortifications within France in order to centralize power on Paris. And this split the city again, because half the people wanted the walls to come down and half the people wanted the walls to stay. And again, it was an issue on which people had to take sides. And Grandier took the side against the destruction of the walls. And that automatically put him against the wishes of the king and his first minister, Cardinal Richelieu. So he had good and strong friends for most of the time that he was there, but he also developed very strong enemies who played a significant part once the accusations were made against him.
How would his position on a matter that would seem relatively minor in terms of taking the walls down relate to all of the other issues you've raised? You're making it a national issue, the personal matters, the religious divisions within the community. How does all this tie into charging a priest with seduction and possession?
The being accused of seduction was... It came about because he seduced the daughter of one of the leading men in town. And it was hushed up. The girl was married off very quickly before a baby was born. There was no way to get back at Grandier from the point of view of the father. He couldn't accuse Grandier of seduction because it would obviously operate against the daughter. So the result was, therefore, that they chose or searched for other means, and The other means they found were to accuse him generally of seduction of women throughout the town and of lechery. And that became a very important issue. And the when he was accused of that, the stories that were going about him crept into the convent. Now, the convent was an enclosed one. The nuns were not allowed out. The convent, the stories got into the convent, and when a crisis occurred within the city, the nuns began to show these signs of possession, and the particular way that it happened was that they showed an absolute obsession with Grandier. The possessions then became important, and because Grandier was against the destruction of the wall, all of these issues became mixed up together. Ultimately, the family that was accusing Grandier of all these things made appeals to the king to treat these possessions as a serious matter. So it then became a national issue that tied all of these factors together.
Now, you mentioned that these nuns hadn't even seen him. So what kind of evidence was used against him?
Well, firstly, there was the record of the possessions themselves. The record started 11 days after the beginning of the possessions, and they went on for some considerable time. And they were very, very carefully recorded. And the things that went on were quite extraordinary. Even today, they'd be quite extraordinary. So there was the record of the possessions. Then, on top of that, of course, there was the specific accusation from the nuns that he was the cause of the possessions and that his spirit, if you like, wandered their convent at night and that he tried to seduce them. The whole business of the accusation against him came into the matter. Then there were specific things that had to do with witchcraft. Firstly, the mother superior of the convent, sometime later, after the actual possession started, sicked up or vomited up a pact with the devil. Now, part of the business of witchcraft was that there was a pact between the witch and the devil. The witch said, if you give me certain powers, I will worship you, and the devil gave him the powers. The pact, therefore, when it was vomited up in this form, which said, I acknowledge you as my master, was a very important sign of the devil. Secondly, there was one, he was accused by one specific person of taking her to a Sabbath. Now, that was a party, if you like, that witches went to where they worshipped the devil. And many witches, if not all, were believed to go to Sabbaths. To be accused of that by somebody was a very serious matter. And finally, there were the devil's marks. It was believed that the devil placed insensitive points on a witch's body, and they were tested for that by the witch hunters. And if the devil's marks were found, as they were allegedly in his case, then that was an almost sure sign of witchcraft. So those were the evidences that were put against him.
Now, you also mentioned earlier exorcism. Was exorcism used in this case to try to treat the nuns in their possession?
Very much so. There were two areas, really. Firstly, the doctors were with the nuns all the time, many doctors, and they treated the nuns. So they affirmed that the nuns were possessed. The priests conducted the exorcisms. Now, the exorcism was a particular set of prayers of the Catholic Church designed to force the devil to leave a possessed person's body. In this case, they started after 11 days of possessions, and they lasted, in one case, up to 6 years later. Now, that was a real problem, because in theory, when he died, after 2 years, when he was executed, the possessions ought to have stopped, and it was one of the reasons why people began to question what happened in the Grandier case. Now, in this particular case, the exorcism started in the convent with priests. And then it moved to where local notables were present as well. So you had the priests and notables. And ultimately, they became public exorcisms with up to 2,000 people present, so everybody saw what was going on. The purpose of that, although it was bad practice, was to convince the Huguenots that the church could, in fact, get rid of the devils. So all of the signs of the possession became public.
Well, if we have these signs and all the other evidence against him, how was the actual trial carried out? What went on at the actual trial?
It was a very big and formal trial. They had 13 judges and 72 witnesses. The evidence covered some 5,000 sheets of legal paper. They met for 18 days for 6 hours a day. So it was a very serious trial. The result of that was that he was committed to death, preceded by torture. And the purpose of the torture was not for punishment, and this is true not only of his case, but of other witchcraft cases. It was to get a confession of guilt and the names of accomplices. It was always assumed that the witch tried, in fact, to recruit other accomplices to worship the devil. Of course, under torture, most people admitted to whatever the questioners wanted. I certainly would. And in this case, he didn't. He held out against it, apart from one small situation in which he admitted to being a witch and then withdrew. So he recanted his admission. But it was a big trial. It was a formal trial and a very serious trial.
Interesting dilemma for them. If he didn't confess and he didn't name names, but the possession continued after he was executed, were there any further actions taken? I mean, it might on the one hand, as you suggest, raise questions as to whether they got the right man, but it might also raise questions as to the existence of other witches that he didn't name.
Well, this is true. It did cause serious concerns subsequently about why did the possessions continue after this. It did lead ultimately to investigations by senior people in the French church as to what had gone wrong. It led to whole questions as to whether the exorcisms had in fact been properly carried out. And certainly the result of that was ultimately that no, they had not been. The results were therefore very questionable. Ultimately, it really led to a whole question within France of whether witchcraft trials were proper means of dealing with some of these issues, and led eventually to the disappearance of witchcraft as a crime within France.
So you see this case as a turning point as well.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Well, one final question, very quickly. How do you explain what went on after the execution? What are your thoughts briefly on that?
Well, the questions, as I started off, have always been, you know, were the nuns possessed? I think today the opinion of that is, no, they were not possessed. They were sick. And to some extent, they were manipulated. There's also been a question of who did the manipulation, and I have come up with my answer on that particular one. Another big question has always been, was Grandier responsible? And for a long time, there were two schools of thought on this. The Catholic viewpoint, if you like, yes, he was absolutely responsible. And the non-Catholic viewpoint, no, he had no responsibility at all. It was judicial murder. I think today that everybody would say that, no, Grandier was not responsible. And then the third question is, who wanted Grandier dead? The father of the girl, of the seduced girl, and his family, the wide family within Loudun, and they wanted him dead. They pursued him to the very end.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it with that. We appreciate your being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Robert Rapley, author of A Case of Witchcraft, The Trial of Urban Grandier, published by McGill Queens University Press. This is Talking History. Thank you. Histories of the European and American witchcraft trials fill library shelves, but new books and new theories as to just what caused the witch hunts continue to appear with regularity. Here to give you a preview of his forthcoming book on the subject, Demon Lovers, Witchcraft, Sex, and Belief, to be published next year by the University of Chicago Press, is Walter E. Stevens, professor of comparative literature at Dartmouth College.
The roots of witch hunting are much earlier than the first known trials. Witch hunting became possible when European intellectuals started taking seriously ideas they had previously dismissed as ignorant delusions, especially the idea that certain people could literally fly by night. From before 1100 to the 1430s, theologians ridiculed the idea that by rubbing themselves with certain ointments, some women could fly away and attend orgiastic gatherings held at night. But within a century, other clerics were using the same folkloric evidence to maintain that devils carried women through the air to frightful orgies overseen by Satan, where witches and devils performed loathsome sex acts together. But clerical theorists of witchcraft had not performed a simple about-face. In the 1430s, they were combating the idea that women flew. By the 1530s, they claimed that women were carried through the air by demons and even had sexual relations with them. The difference was the introduction of physical interaction between witches and demons. As scholars have shown in the context of actual trials, the idea of interaction with demons was introduced by prosecutors and judges, not by accused witches themselves or by the neighbors who accused them. Illiterate people had to be taught that witches consorted with demons. It was 15th century intellectuals, rather than common people, who were anxious to know that such physical interaction with demons was possible. In 1487, the author of the infamous Hammer of Witches declared that he was writing the treatise to prove that demons were not imaginary. He claimed that many educated men considered demons imaginary bugbears or actual hallucinations. However, he said, "We know that demons are real because they give witches the power to harm other people, and that harm is not imaginary. Secondly, witches have sex with demons and are therefore expert witnesses to the reality of demons." In 1523, another writer quoted a witch confessing that she knew demons were real because they had given her more sexual pleasure than men. From the 1450s until after 1700, the shortest and most comprehensive definition of witchcraft was therefore not harmful sorcery, but physical interaction with demons. Since at least 1150, Western Christian theologians had been asking themselves whether demons were pure spirit or had bodies. By 1250, theologians had decided that demons were indeed disembodied, but could fabricate temporary bodies from air. And there was nothing, not even sexual intercourse, that these virtual reality bodies could not perform. By 1450, theologians were claiming that witches had privileged information about the bodies of demons, and thus about their reality. We cannot prove that witch hunting was a direct result of learned men's anxiety over the reality of demons, any more than we can trace witch hunting to any other single cause. But that anxiety was a crucial precondition, and it deserves much more study.
You've been listening to Walter Stevens, author of Demon Lovers, Witchcraft, Sex, and Belief, scheduled for release next year. This is Talking History. Welcome back to our special Halloween show. For our site of the week, we will take you to the heart of Halloween country, the center of witchcraft activity in America, or at least the site of the largest outbreak of witch hunting in American history. Here to tell you more about this well-known but still fascinating historical site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
When you think of witches and witch hunts, Salem, Massachusetts probably comes to mind first. While Salem may be best known for the witch trials of 1692, this historic coastal town boasts an impressive display of historic architecture and is rich in maritime tradition. There is, of course, the Witch Dungeon Museum featuring reenactments of the witch trials, the Witch House, home of Jonathan Corwin, a magistrate during the witch trials, and there's also the McIntyre Historic District with many examples of residential period architecture, and a ride on the Salem Trolley takes you past all the major points of interest. And check out the headstones at the burying point. And not far from that is the New England Pirate Museum, and there is also the Salem Maritime National Historic Site. A little bit of something for everyone can be found in Salem, Massachusetts.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we recommend to you a number of interesting programs airing in the next few weeks on PBS. On November 1st, watch for Hitchcock, Selznick, and the End of Hollywood, an American Masters special that tells the tale of those three epic Hollywood personalities and their work. On November 7th and 8th, you can catch Ken Burns' latest documentary, Not For Ourselves Alone, the study of suffragettes Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. And on the same two nights, November 7th and 8th, look for Stopwatch and Transistorize. Stopwatch shows how the Taylor Stopwatch, named after efficiency expert Frederick Winslow Taylor, revolutionized the American workplace, while Transistorize provides a vivid account of how the transistor also changed the course of business history. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week for our show on Undersea Monsters. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.